I'm assuming this will.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on General Government. Today is May 5th, 2015, and we're opening up a public hearing on House Bill 5034, our public employee retirement system. What do we need to be thinking about first?
Good afternoon, Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee. Before you is the public employees retirement system. Today begins their phase two presentation on their budget to review their policy packages and go through their briefly their reduction options. But also the director of PERS is going to start off with a brief discussion of the recent Supreme Court ruling on the PERS reforms that came out last week. So
excellent.
Thank you, Co-Chair.
All righty. Thank you. So welcome. Come on up. So what I'm going to do is just turn the microphone over to you and let you run with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Steve Rodman. I'm the executive director at the Public Employee Retirement System. I'm joined by Jordan Masanga, who is our chief information officer. And Jordan is here to add some context and information around our policy option packages in the technology world. As he and I have worked together for well over 10 years, including the RIMS conversion project in various roles. So he's moved up to the chief information slot as of about 15 months ago and is heading up our technology strategy development. So Mr. Borden indicated, we figured the first thing you'd want to talk about is the Supreme Court's decision from last Thursday. So let's add a little context to that. The court reviewed the constitutionality of the two Senate bills that were adopted in 2013, Senate Bill 822 from the regular session and Senate Bill 861 from the special session. The court's decision addressed two components. The first component they addressed was the elimination of the tax remedy payments for Oregon, for recipients who do not pay taxes in the state of Oregon because they don't reside in Oregon, and that was upheld. The other provision that the court addressed was the cost of living adjustment or COLA reductions. Those were overturned for members who had benefits that they earned prior to the effective date of that legislation, either of those bills. And so the court's decision sets up what I would have termed a split COLA based on the old rules for those with benefits earned prior to the effective date of the legislation, and then the new COLA rules that would apply to benefits earned after the effective date of those bills. The court's ruling also voided the supplementary payments that were established under Senate Bill 861 to mitigate the COLA reductions.
Can you do a little 101 training on what those supplementary payments were? I don't recall.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The supplementary payments were a series of payments over 6 years starting in 2014 that were roughly meant to mitigate the impact of the COLA reductions. So the COLA generally was reduced to 1.25% with a cap at $60,000. Under the supplementary payments, members were receiving a one-time payment of 0.25 of their benefit payment, and then if they were if their benefit was under $20,000 in a year, they got another 0.25. So those were not compounded. They were one-time payments over 6 years that bridged the reduction in COLA and kept people more or less on track through those reductions. So those supplementary payments, which we paid the first one back in November 2014, are voided and will not be paid in years going forward.
So then will we need to go back and collect those payments on the ones that we issued?
Co-Chair Smith, we're going to talk about what our plans are in that regard. Okay. So we'll get to that. Next. That's what the next slide is all about. What does this mean for the benefit recipients? So we've split this administration of this into basically two groups. The first group is benefit recipients who retired prior to May 1, 2013, because the first bill, Senate Bill 822, was effective on May 6, 2013. So if you retired prior to May 1, it's abundantly clear that you're entitled to a full 2% COLA. So that population is going to receive the COLA under the old rules, the 2% COLA based on the Portland CPI with a bank, plus or minus 2% if the CPI is larger or smaller in that adjustment. So our first priority is going to be to restore the 2% COLA to that population in the next COLA cycle. What we do every year with COLA is we establish what the COLA will be July 1, payable August 1. So the July 1 COLA this year, we're going to program for 2%, because that's going to at least stop the bleeding on the benefits that these people have been adjusted to be entitled to. So we're going to pay them 2% starting this July 1. Then eventually, Co-Chair Smith, to get to your particular question, we will need to make a full adjustment on that population, because they received a reduced COLA in 2013 and 2014. And then the supplementary payments are going to be added into what was already distributed to them. So we'll have to do a true-up of that whole population to not only pay them for COLAs that they did not receive in 2013 and 14, offset by what they did receive in the supplementary payment, but then we need to also get their benefit payments set up so next year in 16, when they get a 2% COLA, it's on the right base benefit. So that's all that work that is to be done in putting the court's decision into play for this population.
Representative Combe.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. My question is actually two parts, because we need both parts before to really have so I can calculate. My first question is, how many retirees are in this group?
In this first group of people who retired prior to May 1,
yes.
our first look is around 121,000.
Okay, and so, and how many retirees is I'm trying to figure out how big of a hole we're in.
We have those numbers.
You have all those.
We have those numbers. I mean, we have, at least I heard from,
sorry,
Mr. Co-Chair, we heard from Senator Devlin what Mr. Redmond and his team have been
telling.
You may want to go into that a little more, Mr. Redmond.
Yeah, just a little bit. Just hit the surface.
Sorry,
so.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Well, I just have a number of family members. I'm one of 14 children, and most of them are state employees, and half of them have retired.
So Representative
Comp. They're very interested in what I'm learning.
Co-Chair Smith, Representative Comp, let me get to the chase as far as that goes. Understand this decision came out Thursday. Thursday afternoon or late in the morning, I appointed one of my staff members as the sponsor for the project to mitigate remedy this effort. And she has already appointed a project lead and a project manager. And we are making this the top priority of this agency to restore these benefits to members that are entitled to them. So the first step of that, as I said, is let's pay a 2% COLA this July 1. Candidly, that's not going to be the right COLA for anybody, because it's not on the right base. You know, the base benefit people have been getting will be wrong, because it hasn't had the corrected COLA from 13 and 14, but at least it's as close as we can come to getting it right and to moving people to where they ought to be. And that's something I can do by July 1. So I can get the COLA started in the right direction July 1. Then the second thing I need to do is go through those 121,000 people and true them all up.
Okay.
And the good news is, of course, this is what we're good at. We know how to do this agency, because we've been through it before. We've had to adjust benefits and take large populations through changes that the courts and the legislature have enacted. So in brief parlance, we got this. We know how to do this. The other thing that I will share, because I can't help but share it, is when I talked about this on Thursday and talked to my executive team about this and put out the information in our agency about the project, I had people volunteering to come onto this project. So there is a challenge, a major challenge for our agency, and my staff are running toward the challenge. So that I just had to put that on the record. I'm so incredibly proud of them and their reaction to that. So I cannot tell you with certainty when those 121,000 people will be adjusted, but it will be the top priority of this agency to do that. And then the ultimate goal is when next July comes around, those people have all been adjusted, they've been paid the right benefit, and so the 2% that they're going to get next July 1 of 16 will just take them forward in the right place that they ought to be.
Mr. Chair,
yep, please.
My only kind of not sarcastic, but in my own way, this way I could tell my family when they can plan their next trip.
Co-Chair Smith,
as long as they take me along free.
That's true. I don't want to create tremendous expectations. These are marginal changes, maybe a half a percent of a benefit. So it's not like it's huge dollar amounts. I wouldn't pay for their vacation based on this, but at least they'll have maybe a nice dinner that we'll be able to buy for them.
Well, that they have earned.
Absolutely.
Let's continue.
So, Co-Chair Smith, the other population are those people who retired after June 1 of 2013. Those are people who are going to be subject to some sort of a blended COLA based on the effective dates of the respective legislation. And that blended COLA is going to be based on the benefit earned before and after the effective date of the legislation. Again, candidly, I'm not quite sure what all that means yet, because the court, it was definitive in saying you have to do the COLA based on the benefit earned. They didn't say what that meant. So we're going to have to come up with some sort of a determination as to how to make that allocation about benefit earned. Do we do it based on service time? Do we do it based on an accrued benefit? That's the work that we have yet to do. But the good news is that population is much smaller. It's only around 10,000 individual benefit recipients. And again, the difference is marginal because we're only talking about the COLA adjustment here. So we'll be working with our DOJ counsel on how to administer that blended COLA. And then once we figured out how to administer it, we will again apply the same process to those individuals. Just to be clear, they'll get a 2% COLA this July 1 because we got to give the same COLA to everybody. So they'll get a 2% COLA, but then we'll come in on the back end and decide what they were entitled to and give them the difference for what they're entitled to. And again, get them set up for July of 16 moving forward.
Madam Co-Chair.
So the 10,000 you're talking about are people who retired between May 1st of 2013 and the day the Supreme Court issued its decision.
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Hayward, actually it's everybody who retired after June 1 and after, because everybody who retires next this June and this July and this August,
right.
We're adding to the population every month.
It was a verb tense issue that I was trying to struggle with.
Okay.
What you're saying is there are 10,000 Tier 1 beneficiaries who had not yet retired and who would have been affected by this decision, who had not retired by May 1st of 2013, but now either have retired or will be retiring?
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Steiner Hayward, it's 10,000 members who have retired. They are Tier 1, Tier 2, and OPSERP. And that's who have retired through the May 1 payroll, the pension roll that we just did.
Right. But, okay, so.
So they all retired.
But there are a lot of other people who are still Tier 1, Tier 2, or OPSERP who have not yet retired.
Correct.
Right? I mean, so we're talking about it's not just the 10,000 who retired between May 1st and now. It's an additional how many hundred thousand? How many tens of thousands? I mean, what's our magic number that we're dealing with here?
Well, under the Supreme Court's decision, everybody who retires from this day forward is going to get some kind of a blended COLA. And so it's the remaining 200,000 people in my membership, assuming say wait till retirement.
Right. So that's exactly. I mean, it's a little bit clearer for those people because you have a before and after the effective date of the legislation.
Right.
There you have that, and you have it going forward, and but it's still a blend. So you're still talking about well over 200,000 people for whom you have to calculate blended rates.
Correct.
Eventually, either now or later.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
So we know the number of people that are going to have to be corrected. Do we know the amount that it's going to result in?
Co-Chair Smith, back of the envelope, probably something in the neighborhood of $30 to $40 million as far as how much back COLA I'm going to owe to these people. And that's just, you know, in my head thinking maybe it's about a half a percent based on 2 years of pension roll.
So when we communicate with these folks, do we do it via snail mail or email?
When we communicate to the benefit recipients about this?
I'm just curious, what's going to be the additional expense of having to communicate with all the members?
Co-Chair Smith, we haven't gotten that far in our thinking about it. We already have communication vehicles that go through snail mail, such as our newsletter,
yeah,
and pay stub messages, and we could leverage those, of course, provided we can get a message put together in time to hit those publication deadlines. At the point at which we actually do a determination on what someone is actually owed, our habit practice has been that we communicate in a letter to those individuals so they have a record of what we determined and how much they're entitled to, and that gives them, of course, the right to challenge that administrative determination, as any member does or any person does in dealing with an agency.
And I guess I ask the question because I'm just curious, because it is what it is. We have to take care of this. I'm just curious what the cost would be. Madam Co-Chair?
So just to add on to that, I hope that you're planning on putting up on the front page of the website, like, ongoing, here's the latest update, because that's, I think, even for an older population, one of the first places they'll look or they'll think to look.
Yeah, Co-Chair Smith, Senator Steiner here, absolutely. We've already understand we're in some early analytics about this. Mm-hmm. This, you know, just information I'm distributing now is our first blush of this project. I'm going to get a project plan on Thursday from my project sponsor that lays out what these timelines look like. And to the degree we can start adding some certainty around timing and expectations, absolutely that will go up on our website. And frequently asked questions around what does this mean for me, and always our practice to put that up as well.
All righty, let's continue.
Okay. So, employer rates. Employer rates have already been set that are to become effective July 1, 2015. So, the PERS Board adopted those back in the fall of 2014. And those rates included the liability reductions from Senate Bill 822 and 861. So, in our normal course of what we would do from this point forward, the next employer rates that we would publish would be for the July 1 of 2017 cycle, and those rates will be issued on an advisory basis this fall. And those advisory rates are based on the valuation that we will conclude as of the end of calendar year 2014. So to elaborate a little bit about that, what we do is we close the books on December 31 of 2014, we assess the assets in the system and the liabilities that the system has to pay, and that creates our financial position, our unfunded liability in this case. Then the actuaries take that unfunded liability and project the extra cost of that on employer rates. If they were to become effective July 1 of 2017. So we take that UAL as of December 31st, 2014, we put it into employer rates to be effective July 1 of 2017 and issue those on an advisory basis this fall. A year from this fall, in the fall of 2016, we will adopt actual employer rates that will be taking effect July 1 of 2017. When the advisory current rates come out this fall, they will reflect the impact or the effect of the repeal or the voiding of the COLA provisions that the Supreme Court has enacted. And then the actual rates will not only, of course, include the impact of that, they will also include whatever investment earnings we get through the course of 2015. The other factor that we have to recognize in the setting of employer rates is that the PERS Board goes through its normal rate setting cycle, and in doing so this summer, they will adopt methods and assumptions that will that the actuary will use to derive the system valuation. One of those assumptions is the assumed rate. And based on analysis from the actuaries on our investment portfolio starting way back in the fall of last year, we know that there will be pressure to reduce the assumed rate because investment return expectations on our current portfolio indicate that our current assumed rate of 7.75 may be too high. So we already have pressure, irrespective of the court's decision, to look at reducing that assumed rate. That discussion is independent, like I say, of whatever happened with the court decision. It's just the normal cycle of what the PERS board goes through in setting the system's assumed rate every 2 years. So you might recall 2 years ago, in the summer of 2013, we reduced that assumed rate from 8 to 7.75. Now we're going to do that review again, and early indications are that that rate will need to be reduced further.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. I understand that what you've just outlined is your standard rate setting procedure. And I also understand that the state is on this crazy extended budget cycle. That means we're, you know, as soon as we walk out the door, we're already starting to budget for the next biennium, which I find tough to imagine. But when it talks about something like a valuation, if you base a valuation for the 17-19 biennium on a valuation that occurred 18 months before those rates take effect, that I find a little bit harder to understand. I mean, I understand that there are moving parts, but an unfunded liability is a hard number. And calculating that based on a valuation from 18 months before worries me a little bit, and I don't understand why that's necessary in this context. It may be a longer conversation than we can have here, and if so, I'm happy to have it offline, but I'm puzzled by it.
I'll try to do it as briefly as I can, Co-Chair Smith, Senator Stanner Hayward. The short answer is it takes that much time, not only for us to develop the valuation, but then also to give our employers fair notice of what their PERS rates are going to be. So it has always been that 18-month lag. It's something we've lived with in our system. The question is always raised when exigent circumstances such as this come into the midst of that cycle, and the question arises as to whether that 18 months is too long or too short. The same questions were raised when investments tanked. The same questions are raised when investments rise substantially. The same questions have been raised when liabilities have been reduced through the legislative process. The difference there, of course, is that the legislature can tell us to redo rates, and you could do that in this circumstance. In 2013, when these cost reductions were enacted, we had already adopted July 1, 2013 rates, but you directed us to redo the 2013 rates based on these, or incorporating these cost reductions. And in 2003, that was the same directive that we got. So I can lay out the timeline in more detail.
I understand now. That's very helpful. I got it. And I also know that actual rates, it's not as if there's a blanket rate statewide. It depends on side accounts and
yes, individual rates.
Individual rates depend on side accounts, and that takes, you know, and other factors, and that takes a lot into, you know, what the age of their entity's population is and all that kind of stuff. So I get all of that, but it's tough to wrap my head around. But I got it.
Well, if I may, Co-Chair Smith, Senator Stanner Hayward, the other point, of course, to consider is we set rates and we run the system for the long term.
Right.
So any rate impact on that is derived from this court decision is going to be spread over our amortization period of 20 years. So, you know, it's not as if it's a quick reaction. It's a deliberate reaction to a long-term problem.
Can I ask a quick follow-up before Senator Whitson? I know he has a question. Thank you, Senator Whitson. So you alluded to this 20-year amortization. For those of us who brief budget, which many of us on this committee do, ultimately, what's your sense of when we're going to have an idea? I mean, obviously, it's hard to know because we don't know what the valuation is really going to look like, and it's hard to predict. But, you know, we know historically what the stock market and what investments like this tend to do over 20-year periods. It's a long enough cycle that you can make a guesstimate. When are we going to have a sense of what rates might look like over the next 20 years. Because as we start to think about budgeting, which, I mean, all of my budgeting assumptions personally have changed dramatically in the past 4 days. And I guess since I expect to be doing budget for the remainder of my legislative career, I'd kind of like to know what I and my successors are going to be dealing with for the next 10 biennia.
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Steiner Hayward, the answer is we have a PERS board meeting at the end of this month,
okay.
And the actuary is coming to that meeting with a report on the implications of this decision.
Okay.
On a general basis, meaning hopefully broken down by some larger groups like the state, schools, independent employers, some of the bigger actuarial groups, then that's why I mentioned the advisory rates. Next fall, every employer, down to their particular individualized impact, will have that answer going
okay.
forward. And the other thing, of course, that the analysis is going to show, this is a big increase in liability, ergo a big increase in rates. We have our rate collaring policy that mitigates that rate increase probably over a series of biennia, two, maybe three. We'll see that played out at this May meeting, as well as in these individualized rates. So not only will you see what 17-19 looks like, but 19-21, 21-23, and then eventually we'll top out once we get to the right cruising altitude, and then you'll hold that altitude until we run out of the amortization and you're back down to normal cost.
Yeah, and that's exactly the kind of thing I want to see. And when that's done, it'd be great if you could send that to Mr. Borden so we can keep that as part of our understanding with this committee's work.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rubin, can you make an estimate of the cumulative increase in employer contributions for 2017-19 if you start with the an assumed earnings rate of, say, you drop it 0.25% or 0.5%, you have the adjustments for the lost UAL and are increased in US UAL, assuming the your estimates of investments returns are, can you just make it in the ballpark figure of what kind of percentage employer contribution is going to go up?
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Whitsitt, well, the reason I struggle with that is because I don't know how the rate collar is going to work for each individual employer, because the rate collar is going to impact how much you're actually going to go up 17-19. I would say at the least, I would expect a 3% increase. The question to me is not the question is not, is that the last increase? Because it undoubtedly is not, unless investment returns are spectacular. It's at least 3%. The question to me is more like, what does 19-21 look like? And is 17-19 mm-hmm. bigger than 3%? Because our rate collar works in two ways. One is, of course, the cap of the increase is 3% or 20% of your current rate. 20% of someone's current rate could be bigger than 3%. And also that cap is raised depending on the individual employer's funded status. So if your funded status is less than 70%, we raise the cap because we need to make sure that we are collecting contributions at a sufficient rate to reduce that, to get that employer back on track. So back of the envelope, I would say at least plan a 3% increase. The only question is it going to be bigger than 3% by some marginal basis for those employers who are affected by the cap in that individual way? And how much gets carried over to 1921?
So if I heard you right, then the likely increase in 1921 would be even larger.
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Whitsitt, that's not what I meant to indicate. What I meant to indicate is I don't know what the increase in 1921 is going to be. If, for example, the total increase from this is, let's say, 4.5%, just to pick a number, and you go up 3% 17-19, you're going to need to get that extra 1.5% in 1921, and there's going to be a little extra added onto that because you waited until then to start paying it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm saying. I don't know what 1921 looks like because I'm not sure how much I'm carrying over. And again, it's broken down to individual employers and their impact. Also, let's not forget, by the time 1921 rolls around, that's going to be based on the 2017 valuation, which is going to have two and a half years of investment returns, which will have a much bigger impact on the system given that we're a $70 billion portfolio. This is the initial indications. For example, this was a $5 billion increase in our unfunded liabilities, $70 billion portfolio. 1% of that is a significant effect. So the stock market is going to have a big swing as far as where those rates go and how long they have to increase and at what rate. And there's a lot of time between now and that.
So, and one final question. Do you envision then that the effects of this Supreme Court decision will peak in the 1921 biennium, given that the investments continue for the next 5 years?
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Whitsitt, yeah. Yes, I think that's how the rate collar will work on this order of magnitude, is that by 1921, we'll look at topping out the impact from this court decision.
Thank you.
So knowing that the Supreme Court just reminded us that this is a contract and that we're going to honor our contract, is it a fair assessment to say that, and I don't mean to be morbid, but I mean, we're going to be managing this through the life cycle of our Tier 1 PERS employees?
Co-Chair Smith, I don't mean to. It's worse than that. It isn't just the Tier 1s, don't forget. It's total liability and Tier 2 and OPSERP. And as Senator Steiner Hayward pointed out, it's everybody who retires from this day forward. So we're going to be managing the implications of this until the population that is living or entitled to some form of a 2% COLA wears away. That population probably won't wear away for 40 or 50 years.
So, Mr. Chair,
it is what it is at this point.
That was depressing.
Yeah, Madam Co-Chair.
That's really depressing. So just to be clear, anybody who is hired after May 13th of 2013 is only entitled to the new COLA.
That's correct.
Because that contract was established after that law was passed.
That's correct.
Okay. But that's a lot of us who are still there. Okay.
But it is what it is. I mean, the Supreme Court has now shared with us it is what it is. All right, let's continue on.
Okay. So just to reiterate what this means for the agency again, the top priority is to restore these benefits to individuals that are entitled to a return from us. I already went through the three phases of that. So unless there are any other questions, I'll move along from this slide. And that was the last I was going to talk about the Supreme Court decision specifically, and if there's any final questions before I move on to looking at our policy option packages and what those policy packages mean to us moving forward.
Is there any other questions? Colleagues, let's proceed forward.
Thank you. So just as a quick agency overview, you've seen this before. This is off of our fundamentals map and was in our phase one presentation. This just shows our key goals and our outcome measures. These are the things by which we judge whether we're doing a good job. And I just wanted to reiterate the alignment from our outcome measures to the key performance measures that you have established for us and where those connections occur. So this slide just emphasizes that how we judge the success of our agency is aligned to the key performance measures that you have assigned to us, as well as some other measures that we have instituted. So to improve in our performance in those key performance measures, we have different policy packages that we outlined for you. And again, we summarized in our phase one presentation, but want to go through in more detail with you today. So the first one of those is the analyst adjustment. This is the adjustment that our DAS analyst made when our agency request budget was run through to become the governor's recommended budget, or I'm sorry, whatever the governor's budget. Governor's balanced budget. They changed the name.
It's not balanced.
So in any case, what the analyst did was reduce our limited funds expenditure by about $1.1 million, and we allocated that across personal services and services and supplies, as noted. And the reduction was justified or explained because historically, our agency has underspent its expenditures, and so it's been our budget for the next cycle was adjusted in recognition that our actual expenditure experience has been averaging well below our budget authority. We take very seriously the fact that every dollar we spend on running the system is a dollar that does not go toward funding benefits for our members. So we are good stewards. As my predecessor, Mr. Cleary, said, we ride with tight reins, and consequently, the budget reduction from the analyst was reflected there. The other increases were in our non-limited budget. Those were just based on some better projections that we had made as far as what our expenditures are going to be for benefit payments to Tier 1, Tier 2 ops or IP, and then the health insurance premiums are pass-throughs predominantly of premiums for our members who are in our health insurance programs.
Senator Whitson.
I think you're on your the $2.463 billion in benefits. Is that going to be sufficient to pay the benefits now that the changes have been made in the COLA?
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Whitson, which number are you looking at?
On the top line.
Up there. Sorry, thank you. That was based on our projections when the analyst budget was issued last fall. We haven't looked at these again, given the Supreme Court's decision. That's a good addition to the to-do list. Thank you.
Part of what I always have to remind myself when I look at this is that those are not assets, but those are the dollars that are going to pass through in this biennium.
That's correct.
Yeah. It's a lot of cash.
Yes.
Any questions, colleagues? Let's continue forward.
So policy package 101 is our current service metric staffing. And here we're asking for 6 positions, 4 call center staff, 1 retirement counselor who will do officer calculations, and then the custodial staff, which is basically just a swap from DAS. So the 4 call center staff, I've gone through some metrics before, and this slide came out of our response to your questions from phase one. You wanted a little more particular look at the effect that these call center staff had on our metrics. So this breaks it down by month and shows you how when those call center agents came on in March of 2014, that the abandonment rate went down dramatically and the wait time went down dramatically. So it just shows that by putting the right bodies in the right place, we're able to maintain these metrics. Now, as I said, every one of these policy packages has to be reviewed in light of the fact of the Supreme Court's decision. I will tell you that my need for 4 call center staff are enhanced by this Supreme Court decision. I'm going to get more questions and more inquiries as we roll out, and I want to make sure we get to them in a timely manner.
Madam Co-Chair.
That was actually my question, was really, is 4 enough, or do you need a couple of other short-term LD people at least for the next year while you're sorting all of this out to do this? I mean, obviously, as you quite rightly said, every dollar you spend on staff is dollars that don't grow on behalf of the members. But on the other hand, having our members be frustrated and confused is not so good for us either. So, I would appreciate your thoughts, if not today, then soon, on that issue.
And Co-Chair Smith, Senator Stender Hayward, I would say let us put the plan together to do that. So far, our phones have not been overwhelmed by this decision. I think because people just quite honestly don't know what it means for them. But when I send out 120,000 letters, I'm going to get some phone calls, and we'll need to be ready for that.
Yeah.
Senator Johnson.
I think the piece that goes with it, and it's lessons learned from Cover Oregon, is to make sure that these people are adequately trained. They are making some significant comments to people seeking information. And when we had high school students fielding some of the Cover Oregon calls, that was a disaster.
No kidding.
So I would just urge you to put into your calculus what's the most efficacious way of training these folks so that they all have consistent information and you get the caliber of person on the phone that can deal with people that are going to be, in some cases, either angry or freaked out.
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, we will absolutely do that. What we've done in the past,
both
in staffing up for these sorts of things, is we're very adept at moving people with questions in an isolated subject to an isolated place. In other words, We've had most of this experience around our annual statements. When we send out annual statements, members call with questions. We staff up for that, and we direct annual statement calls to that annual statement staff. And when I say we staff up, we pull them from other places in the agency so they know PERS. We don't just hire them off the street. So we have a team of 5 or 10 people who have given us a day or a half a day to answer phones and keep up with the responsiveness. So we will plan accordingly.
I was just reminded our PERS members are going to actually be receiving additional income, not having it cut. So some of them
helps.
May not be as gung-ho to call. So
that's fair.
Yeah. All right. Let's continue on.
Same or similarly, I should say. So the call center staffing, like I say, I think the need for that is self-evident and emphasized again by the Supreme Court's decision. The ops or retirements, this is again a chart that I threw into the answer to my phase one questions, but I didn't label it very well and I didn't explain it. So let me just take a second to look at this. This compares the number of retirements that we calculate and start paying within 45 days of an effective retirement date. So starting with the left-hand column, July 1 of 2014, we had 1,664 Tier 1 and Tier 2 members apply for retirement, and we paid 64% of them within 45 days. We had 173 OPCERT members retire on that day, and we only paid 39% of them within 45 days. So if you read across, you see that our OPCERT performance lags the Tier 1 and Tier 2 in terms of the number of people we get in 45 days until we get all the way over to January 2015, where we finally got the OPCERTs over 80% for that one period. But you also see how the volume of retirements is pretty small relative in January. So the point is the OPCERT staff person that I'm asking to have would work on those OPCERT calculations with the point of getting their performance consistently up to the same level as a Tier 1, Tier 2. Because to me, the key performance measure is payments of retirement within 45 days. It shouldn't matter if you're a Tier 1, Tier 2, or OPCERT. You should expect that same level of performance out of us. And so that's relating to the OPCERT calculations. So I'll just pause there on Package 101 if there's any questions about that.
I think we're good.
Package 102 is our integration of the Individual Account Program Administration into Orion or the Oregon Retirement Information Online Network. This package is for phase three of our project to bring that integration from a third-party administration over into PERS. This is the first package where we might have to make some adjustment in the timeline because of the Supreme Court decision. When I told you that our first priority is to make sure that we pay those members the benefits to which they're entitled because of the Supreme Court's decision, when I told that to Mr. Masanga, his answer to me was, I've only got so many people I can have working on anything at one time. And some of the people who are now on the IAP project were in the Senate Bill 822-861 project, so they know that functionality, and it would make sense to pull them off of IAP and move them over here to the restoration project, and that would perhaps delay our execution on the IAP. That's not a conclusion. That's a suspicion as to what we might need to come back to you with. This project was already going to run through the end of the biennium meeting, June 30th of 2017. We may ask to extend it 6 more months and do the cutover at the end of the calendar year 2017 instead of sometime during the year of 2017. But let us do a little more refinement on those expectations before we set the project plan back to you. But this is where I think we might see some movement on that timing.
Thank you. The three limited duration positions, those, once this is up and running, those people will no longer be needed. Is that correct?
Correct.
So that would reflect why the impact for 17-19 is only $33,000, because those three people will no longer be needed.
Correct.
Okay.
Jordan, you want to elaborate a little bit on what those three LDs would do?
Sure. Co-Chair Smith and Senator Whitsitt, My name is Jordan Sang, for the record, and I'm the CIO for PERS. To answer your question, Senator Whitsitt, the idea is to have these three limited duration positions working on the project throughout the rest of the biennium. We would want to pause and see whether those positions still is required for the following year. I just don't know exactly how much support and maintenance I need once I move the system over in-house. But these positions will allow me to at least start that gauging and really understand whether those positions will be needed long-term.
Okay. I've got another follow-up on that IT project. Are you following the DASIS stage gate process, and could you talk to a little about the quality assurance you have on that?
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Whitsitt, yes, we are following the stage gate process, working with Edward Erebus, our DAS analyst, and making sure that the information is captured and that we are managing a risk throughout the whole process.
And you have a quality analysis, a third party looking at that?
Yes, sir. We have engaged with a company called Maximus. They're independent QA oversight. They have, in fact, delivered the first initial risk assessment report about 2 weeks ago. I believe DAS has a copy of that as well as LFO.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. Continue.
So package 103 is our data verification staffing. As you might recall, this package is to increase the staff in our data verification program to be able to meet the demand of our members for this product. A very tough question, of course, again, in light of the Supreme Court's decision as to whether this is a package that we want to pursue. But as my operations director rightly told me, we have a duty to our active members as well as our retired members. And this is a service to our active members to help them plan for their retirement. So these seven people that we're asking for in the data verification unit are needed to make sure that we can enhance our service metric on this product and provide them information in a meaningful and timely manner.
Can you really quick do a 101 training and tell us what do people do in data verification?
So a data verification is something a member can request within 2 years of retirement that tells them what our records say about their account balance, their final average salary, and their years of service and sick leave and maybe one other element I can't recall right now. Anyway, once that data verification is issued, those are the minimum balances we use to generate a retirement. So it locks the member in to the basis of the information that we will use at retirement.
So who does the research? If an employee calls up and says, I think you've missed something, who does the research to verify if the employee is correct or not?
So, Co-Chair Smith, when a question arises from a member or an employer, we engage both of them in the resolution of that. So when a member says, I think you missed a segment of my employment here, we contact the employer and engage that employer in the research related to that. The member has some period of time to challenge that data verification once it's received. So they get it, and then they can look at it, and then they can tell us if there's something we need to adjust in it. And we go back to the employer and verify or question what the member's saying to see whether it is relevant. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. Sometimes they may not have been working in a PERS qualifying position, or they may have been working under like a federal program that didn't qualify for PERS. You're going back 20, 30 years, so sometimes what people expected and what is reality don't match up.
Got it. Thank you. Thank you.
So the bottom line on this package is, that we continue to emphasize the need to improve our service delivery in data verifications. What they do is not really going to be in support of or related to the work we do in the Supreme Court work, but it is a service we are required to provide to current members and need to do a better job of executing on that.
Go back to the previous slide. So I want to make sure I understand that. So to meet our target of 180 days, that means I call today with my question, we're trying to provide an answer within 180 days of the time.
No, Co-Chair Smith, you submit a request for data verification. It's not just a question. You have to tell me, this is what I want you to produce for me. And my service metric is to respond to that data verification request within 180 days. And because of the backlog, I'm not doing that. Because I've got so many people in the queue ahead of you.
180 days, that's a long time.
Absolutely right.
Right, why you have a package 103 in front of us, huh?
Absolutely right.
Okay. Thank you. That makes sense to me.
Okay. Package 104 is our technology enhancements. And here again, we get back to the need to be a little more considerate of this package in light of the Supreme Court's decision.
Can you go back for 1 second, yeah. Mr. Coach? Madam Co-Chair. Can you go back to 103, Mr. Edman?
It takes time to process, doesn't it?
Yeah, I just had to sort of push through my head. If I remember correctly, and if I'm hearing you correctly, what you're talking about is someone's getting ready to retire, and they ask for an estimate of benefits, and they ask for their salary history and all that kind of stuff, and you send them what you've got, right? And they say, no, that's not what my records show. I think I earned much more than that in the following years, right? And you say, okay, submit a request for data for verification, and you go back and you coordinate with all their employers who are PERS employers over the preceding umpteen years that they've been working for the state, right? So far, so good?
Yes.
Okay, good. So, and if I remember correctly also, what you told us in the past was one of the reasons this takes so long is because you have to track down all these records from the employers, as opposed to getting them, for example, from the Department of Revenue with W-2 data, or from employment, or from any of the other places that collect these data based on workman's comp payments or whatever it is. And so you have to go to the employer instead of going to another state agency. Is that also correct?
Yes.
And this is where I'm getting to my real question. Why can you not get this from employment or revenue?
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Steiner Hayward, our determination of eligibility is based on hours worked. So they don't tell the Department of Revenue or Employment how many hours they worked. They just tell them what they got paid. So I need a determination from the employer as to how many hours that individual worked in a calendar year or even in a month if there's a question about the eligibility for that month.
But basically it's a question of were they at least 75% FTE or not? Is it binary, or does somebody worked boatloads of overtime all the time? Does that change their benefit calculation based on hours as opposed to money?
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Steiner Hayward, the standard in the statute is 600 hours in a calendar year, and that is with any PERS employment. So it's not an FTE equivalent. It's the number of hours, and it's combined with concurrent employment or serial employment, even if you work from one job to the next.
Check. Or for those of us who work for two state agencies, more than two jobs. Okay.
Senator Whitson.
Yeah, that's just the point I was going to make. It is a cumulative. We had a situation in Climas, and I'm sure you may be aware of it, that a local park district hired some teachers during the summertime to do work for them. And one of the teachers just simply asked to have be paid in PERS benefits as opposed to wages during the summer, which triggered the requirement if one, it has to be all, and then they go back. And so, I mean, PERS has been looking at this for 2 or 3 years, trying to figure out who worked there and how many hours they worked and whether they cumulative had 600 hours or not. And the Park District is bankrupt.
Let's continue.
I will just point out one thing, if I might, related to 103 and Senator Steiner Hayward. It goes back to the scenario that you were painting about the member and their engagement with us. I wish it was as you laid out. More likely, the engagement now is a member seeks to retire and at the same time asks for data verification because they want to lock down their retirement data. And that is not for planning. That's for a guarantee of a minimum benefit. What we're trying to do through our strategic plan, which I also talked to you about a little bit in my phase one, is we're trying to move that review of the members up in time and expose the information. Because what you both talked about in terms of what the member can find out, everything we have about the members online now. A member can go in and look at their employment history, look at their years of service, look at their salary, and find discrepancies now instead of waiting until the end of this process or the time of retirement to do that. And so if we can engage members sooner and throughout their careers to do that review, and then also if we can lock down the data so that a member who looks at it today doesn't have to relook and relook and relook, as an employer could go back and change something from 2008 or 1994. If we can lock the data down, that would also make basically data verifications less and less relevant. So that is strategically what we're trying to do. But until we get there, we have a product that we need to produce, and we need to produce it on a more timely basis.
Thank you.
Package 104, Orion Maintenance and Enhancements. Two components of this. One is technical debt. And again, Jordan can speak in more detail to that. The other is OPSERP functionality. So the two components of that, first, let's talk about the technical debt package. And Jordan, would you explain a little bit about what that's supposed to address?
So JClarity is our pension administration system that was the result of the RIMS conversion project. At 2011, that was the time when the vendor handed over the code line to me. Since then, I've been opening up the hood, making some changes, and I've noticed a number of architectural design flaws in that system. We can continue on adding bandages to the system, but there are some really core functionality that I really need to fix. This is what the technical debt portion is on this POP.
So, Senator Johnson.
I want to make sure that I heard you correctly. We have gotten a product from a vendor. You have now looked at the product and find it structurally deficient to achieve the purposes for which it was commissioned. What's the recourse? Is this yet another IT project that the state has either gotten bamboozled by a slick vendor or incompetence or failure to oversee? Or it's like almost every day we're hearing about yet another IT failure. Could you elaborate a little bit?
I would love to. Senator Johnson, the purpose of this is really not to throw away what they delivered to us. Really is optimize the system. I can see a lot of things that I'd like to do to optimize the system to provide better services to our members, better services to employers. It isn't that it is a failure. It's actually been a very big success. There's a point where we start having to grow. Data is growing, the volume is growing, the complexity, such as the ruling, is hitting us, and I can't. It's very hard for me to apply some agility to the system. In order for me to do that, there are some things that I would like to fix in the underlying system that will allow me to be more agile.
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, if I might, it isn't that we didn't get what we paid for. We did. What we paid for and what was delivered in 2011 was a 2003 system. And it's just a matter of the growth in technology capabilities and the understanding of how to administer a complex computer system that we're now trying to pay the debt on. So a couple of examples I gave you in this slide. For example, they didn't anticipate OMS, our online member service, needing to be robust, because when they delivered the system in 2003, not very many people were doing business over the web. And then the system was an administration system, not an outward-facing system. So it's those sorts of – that's the debt that we're trying to pay in this development.
Thank you.
Yep.
I'm very happy to be corrected. I'm glad I asked for clarification. Having said that, is this just failure to anticipate, given the operative circumstances, what you say, we weren't doing that much business in 2003 on the web? is there any recourse, or we got what we paid for and now we're trying to cobble together something that is bigger, faster, more capacity?
Senator Johnson, the answer really is trying to keep up with the technology. As Mr. Rodman mentioned, that was 2003 technology. Things have changed quite a bit.
Okay.
That I have to keep up with that pace.
Thank you. I appreciate the clarity. Thank you.
No. Representative Nathanson, then I'll go to Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just put up my hand a few moments too late following Senator Johnson. I took note immediately of what we were just learning about just now. Some of what I wondered has been answered, but I'd like to continue this for just a moment to clarify a few things, since there is another Ways and Means subcommittee that looks into IT issues, because we try to learn from the past and understand how to make things better for the future and avoid problems that have arisen. You mentioned that in 2003, someone wasn't anticipating more business being done over the web. Whose responsibility would it have been? Us in making the business case for what we wanted to have designed, or is there also some responsibility on the part of the vendor to let us know, mm-hmm. this is the way things are developing and we advise you ABC, or is it maybe in their best interest to not necessarily provide us the product that would last the longest, because then we need to return to the vendor to buy the next iteration of something?
Oh, you cynic.
Co-Chair Smith, Representative Nathanson, first off, not just to preview coming attractions, we are scheduled to come to that subcommittee next week.
Okay.
So we will talk in much more detail about this in the IT-related venue. But it's certainly a fair question to ask. I guess it's just the evolution of what are essentially boutique systems, because there's not a whole lot of market for retirement system administration. And so, you know, we bought a system in 2003 that was an improvement from the system they sold to Nevada, that Nevada probably put in 2000. And right now they're putting a system in Texas Teachers based on ours. And I wish we could have the Texas Teachers system, because, you know, guess what? They're going to have things like mobile connectivity that we didn't build in 2003. So it is this just regular evolution of technology systems. What Jordan is going to strategize, has been, and will continue to strategize on, is how do we leverage what we have using these new technologies? Because in the IAP project, we're not changing Clarity as much as we're overlaying functionality to Clarity that will pull from Clarity, but then allow us to administer in a updated environment. And it's that front interface that you're going to see more and more commonly, that we do, so we don't have to scrap what we have, but just make what we do have more compatible with needs today. Was that fair, Jordan?
Yes.
Thank you. I'm really pleased to hear that we have the talent. I appreciate your ability to look at what we have and make it more useful, to pull out what we can, to improve what we do by making the most of what we have already. I appreciate that you're able to do that, and I'm going to hold the rest of my questions for next week when there's a more detailed and perhaps more in-depth look at this kind of issue more generally. And for now, I guess it's really our job to make sure for this budget and for this agency you're able to get done what you need to do.
So I'm going in the order I see hands. So I'm going to Senator Whitsitt, then I'm coming to the representative, then I'm coming back to Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So basically, we're taking a 46 Ford and we're upgrading it. We've sanded it and painted it, and we've put rolled and pleated upholstery in it, and we've added turn signals and all this sort of thing, and fuel injection and a new engine. At some point in time, we're going to want to replace the 46 Ford. When does that occur? Is this going to be in 3 years or 5 years? I mean, at what point in time is it no longer possible to upgrade that system?
Co-Chair Smith, you've already asked us that question, and we intend to come back in the next biennium with that future technology plan. This spend in this biennium is going to take it off of blocks. I don't know whatever the right metaphor is. Get us the bridge, and establish the proof of concept so we know how to build out into the future. We have to make some fundamental decisions, such as the Tier 1, Tier 2 system is wedded in with the OPSERP system right now under this administration. OPSERP is a much simpler program so long as there aren't future changes to it. Can we split that administration and have a more off-the-shelf system to administer OPSERP? IAP is another element of that, like I say, a proof of concept of overlaying this functionality into it. So, Senator Whitsitt, the answer is we plan to come back to you with that in the next budget cycle and give you a longer-term vision on our technology needs.
Mr. Rodman, I'd be a lot more comfortable spending $3.5 million if you knew had a little better idea of that, what you're going to say 2 years from now.
Okay. Fair enough, sir.
Representative.
Thank you. Actually, my question was the same as Senator Whitsitt, so I think I'm good. Thank you.
All righty. Okay. Senator Johnson.
I guess as this presentation has unfolded, first starting with the court decision and then watching this unfold and the level of complexity and the level of money that we're talking about, I at least see a cautionary tale. In legislatures way back when, the idea of setting up a public employees retirement system was a wonderful idea for good and noble purposes. Look at the impact that this is going to have on our budget now for the next 3 decades. And I think the cautionary tale is the rush in this building to get into a state retirement system. I have said to people, you like PERS, you're going to love a state retirement system with all of its complexities. And I am just concerned that we think about it in terms of the metastasis of the program and the need for money and the complexity over time. For good reasons, valid, appropriate, that the legislature feels compelled to create these programs. But look at how difficult this is now. And the gargantuan bite that it takes out of our budgets and those of other budgets that we're responsible for, K-12, community colleges, university, I just think it's worthy to pay attention to.
Representative Kamp.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I want to go back to the description of the contracts, the tech IT contracts. When I buy a house, I get a pretty thorough plan, whether it's 15, 20, or 30 years. And when we buy tech, when we do, I guess my question, and it may fit much better in Rep. Nathanson's committee, why is it, because we now are at a stage of time in technology that we know in 30 days this is out of date. And so that, and I just wonder how we can, it might take 20 lawyers to figure it out, but how can we make sure the contracts that we sign will meet our needs for at least 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, or what, so that there's a clause so that we can make changes as needed or something, because to be locked into these contracts the way that we appear to, from my perception, to be, is not serving as well. But that's just, yeah, I'm just wondering how we should write our contracts. Maybe Rep. Nathanson knows already.
Madam Co-Chair.
Well, I'm just going to take the liberty, since Senator Johnson brought up a very appropriate general point about how decisions one legislature makes or a couple affect many of us many years down the road. I think we are seeing new ways to handle major IT systems with cloud-based stuff, with contracts that are designed The core system replacement for DOR is the one that this committee has obviously seen a lot of, and you'll remember that that one not only includes the whole implementation, but it includes a user group of 20 other states that are doing this, and ongoing improvements and ongoing maintenance of the system that are not the response. We have to pay for them, but we pay for, it's like paying for Adobe Creative Suite, right? You're not paying to have the software and download it onto your computer, and then you have to pay for upgrade and upgrade and upgrade. You pay a subscription, essentially, and it's like a subscription to anything else. You get new content. Now, whether there's an analogous system for public, for, you know, for pension systems or whatever, and one that manages the complexity of a system like ours that has three different benefit structures and now multiple ways of calculating those benefits, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's a different issue altogether. But the points that we're hearing here about J-Clarity really actually articulate, as both you and Senator Johnson have said, the challenges that face us as we think about IT systems when they do go out of date fairly quickly and we don't have a clear thought process. And I'm not blaming either of the gentlemen sitting in front of us because, you know, that was long ago in a galaxy far away, or at some level it was, and before we really started to have as many cloud-based systems or whatever. So I think you're exactly right, Representative Comp, and it's something that a lot of us, certainly Representative Nathanson in her role as chair of the subcommittee on IT, are thinking about carefully. We're moving into an era with new models for software, and it's for exactly this reason. So, which was not a question, Mr. Chair, but a comment.
Okay. Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. I do have one other question. On the J-Clarity IT project, can you discuss the PERS interaction with LFO and the DAS stage gate process on that project?
Commissioner Smith, Senator Whitsitt. In my hand, I have the report from Maximus. They provided they spent about 2 months on site assessing the project, our ability to manage the project from beginning to end. The report has been submitted to both the agency as well as to DAS and LFO. You know, the report really just shows that we have a very good project management in-house. We have the ability to take an IT project, start it, and complete it on budget, on time. The report doesn't show anything otherwise. I would invite you to read the report. Perhaps Ms. Borden can give you a copy of that. Mm-hmm. But as far as the stage gate process, we are marching along for IAP. We are in touch with DAS and the state's CIO office to ensure that transparency is in there. We have not had any concerns or high risk that we have to address so far with IAP. And
if I may, Co-Chair Smith, Senator Whitsitt, we haven't, as to this package, we have not resolved with LFO and DAS how this would be managed in the next biennium. So if I could parse it out a little bit, we've talked only so far about the technical debt piece, which was a million. This top line, which is about $1.3 million, the bottom line or the next line down is about $1.9 million for OPSERP functionality. That is the piece where we need to put a pause on our plans in light of the Supreme Court decision, because this OPSERP functionality was going to be some member administration and benefit administration pieces of OPSERP that were not built when this was originally constructed. And this is even older than the J-Clarity OPSERP system or Orion system. Anyway, the point is, as Jordan alluded to in your Chevy example says, once you get the hood up, you might want to mess around with some other stuff while you got the hood up. So this is a piece where we got to raise the hood to do the COLA. While we got the hood up to do the COLA, maybe there's some other pieces we could integrate into that project. And that's one, Senator Whitsitt, to come full circle, where I would expect $1.9 million expenditure needs to go through and to address the Supreme Court decision, probably needs to go through that stage gate process as an identified project to make sure we get that functionality piece built correctly. But that's separate from the technical debt piece, which is more of maintenance and enhancement ongoing work that we would do.
Can you go one slide back? Taylor, did you have a question?
I just had a quick question. I guess I'm just, thank you, Chair. I just wanted to just see if there's some general government guidelines that generally we like to see. So things like, is there a certain percentage every biennium you spend or plan on spending on IT? Is there a certain, strategic plan going forward about how you're going to be implementing, anticipating that, as Representative Compa saying, it's going to go out of business? You have to have updates. Just the general parameters we like to see, saving a certain amount of money every year, building up, if you're able to. Oftentimes, a lot of government budgets aren't able to do that. Do you have any mechanism for, or do you always have to come back and ask for the one in a pop, or just the kind of the general parameters we like to see for just to assure us that, because I know you're a smart, competent man, but I want to make certain that the right safeguards are in place.
Co-Chair Smith, Representative Taylor, there's a couple of things to address that. One is, what we're asking for are policy packages over and above the normal allocation we have for our IT professional services and maintenance and enhancement work that we do with that.
What percentage of that do you try to keep even?
I don't know what our current budget is on that. It's changed so much because every time the legislature made a change in 13, we got additional limitation. So I don't recall off the top of my head what that was. I thought I might have been getting a whisper from the back.
Okay, so there isn't a percentage you try to keep it in.
No, that's as far as a pure dollar amount. What I was going on to was one of our key performance measures is just our agency administrative expenses per member. Mm-hmm. There's a target for that that's $135 per member, and we're well below that. We're like $125. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not related to IT. That's just overall. Mm-hmm. That's just a key performance measure that you track. The other thing that I alluded to a little bit in my phase one is that we engage a benchmarking company, CEM Benchmarking, that compares us to peer group retirement administration systems and breaks down where we are more and less expensive. We are more expensive in IT than other systems because the system that we've instituted does so much of our work. So we invested in IT rather than people. Back in that phase one presentation I showed you, our staff has pretty much stayed level, while the amount of benefits and the members that we administer for have increased dramatically in the last 10 years. So we're more expensive as an IT component because of that, and we've done the project, and we have the M&E pieces, and we have all these changes that come through the legislative process that make our IT spend higher than other systems. But just anecdotally, I'll tell you, for example, the New York City teachers system, I went on this benchmarking service as a conference. They hosted the conference there. They do, I'm not lying, 100 deployments of into their IT system a day because it's so antiquated, practically every member they generate a benefit for, they have to do some change into their system. So they have a lot of people that write code all day long to go into their old system. Okay. We have a different path.
Thank you.
So I need some clarification. And on the line that says PERS request $3,281,000, other fund limitation to create a team of existing staff and contractors to update GA Clarity's architecture. They're existing staff. So what are we going to use the $3 million plus for?
Jordan is going to hire developers and analysts to help us through the system development lifecycle. Contractors, yes.
Okay, that's going to work with our existing staff.
Right, right.
All right, and so can you go back to that previous slide?
Sorry.
There we go. So once these contractors update GA Clarity's architecture, I assume there's going to be a level of training and teaching and working together between existing staff and the contractors. The
right.
contractors will go away.
Right.
Okay. So it's a one-time expense.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. That's what I needed.
Perfect. Yes.
We've got 10 minutes.
Right.
So I want to make sure you have...
Nine.
No, that's fine. The last package to cover is package 105, and this is our disaster recovery. Again, this is work really independent of what the Supreme Court has said. This is just the responsibility we feel to make sure that we have the business resumption, business continuity capabilities in case of a localized event. to continue to generate and put out the high dollar amounts that we do into Oregon's economy so that Representative Kopp and her siblings continue to receive their benefits on a regular basis. So this ask is for systems development work on the hardware side of things that, again, doesn't engage much with the Supreme Court, but still think to be necessary work to move forward in the next biennium.
Do we have offsite backup for all your data?
So we have tape backups that we do.
How often? Nightly?
Nightly and monthly.
Yeah. And those are stored offsite. Yeah. The point is, though, that we could. So our business continuity plan right now is should a localized disaster happen and our building gets wiped out, next month we will rerun the prior month's pension roll.
How long would you. Let's assume the worst, and let's assume it is wiped out.
Right.
Tornado hits, and how long would it take for a retired PERS member to get their next check?
Their next check is not a problem as long as they're already retired. So okay. I can rerun my May 1 pension roll, June 1, July 1. What I lose in this is who do I add and who can I adjust?
I see. Okay. Yeah, Madam Co-Chair.
So just to be clear, you're still doing tape backup, right?
Yes.
And that means you have to physically take those tapes off-site somewhere. So it's a two-part question. How often do you do that?
On a weekly and a monthly basis.
So you only take those tapes off-site once a week?
Yes, once a week and a monthly basis. So we have both dailies, and then we roll up to weekly, take it off-site, and then we also have a monthly off-site at Iron Mountain. Mm.
And okay, so it's a three-part question now. So what's best if you are doing something like that that's taped that you have to manually take off-site, what's best practices around that? Once a week, to my mind, with given everything that you guys are doing, strikes me as an awful lot of data. Heck, I worry if I don't back up my iPhone once a week, little, and that doesn't have anywhere near, it's backed up to iCloud half of the time, right? So am I wrong? I mean, is once a week a perfectly reasonable interval to do that on? I'm not trying to be difficult. I just don't understand because it just seems different from what I think.
So Co-Chair Smith, Senator Steiner here, again, what we lose is a week's worth of work. So all the processing that someone's done in that week, that our staff has done in that week, gets lost if our system gets destroyed. That's why we want to move to a disaster recovery system where we have servers that are offsite and that can be running in parallel, so we don't lose any of the work that we've done. And then the other thing that having those offsite servers allows us to do under a virtual desktop environment in single sign-on is have our staff work from anywhere that they can connect into those servers instead of today, if our building, the tornado hits our building, then the question is, where do I have those people sit for the next time that they actually have to do some work? I can't even solve that. But through this package, I'll be able to solve that.
Senator Johnson?
You are completely contained in your own data management world, are you not? You're not part of the...
Not for our retired administration, Senator Johnson. We do have like email and some things that are through the data center.
Okay. So nothing that you're doing with any of these packages are going to reflect on increase in charges through the data center?
That's correct.
You're managing your own costs.
Correct.
Yes.
Let's continue. We've got 5 minutes to wrap up here.
Oh, I was really hoping not to have any time because the next thing to talk about is the 10% reduction. So. Let me talk just briefly then about fiscal impacts for a couple of 2015 bills. There are a couple of bills moving their way through the legislative process that do have fiscal impacts for my agency. One is Senate Bill 370, which is currently in the House Business and Labor Committee. It has already passed the Senate. It creates a new benefit for OPSERP members who divorce prior to retirement. And we have a fiscal impact of $225,000 to develop that functionality to be able to divide that OPSERP benefit with a former spouse. The other is House Bill 3495, which has already passed the House and is now in the Senate and is up for a public hearing on Monday at 1. And what that does is it standardizes the contribution start date for OPSERP members, because the way OPSERP was written, it starts on the first of the month with our 900 employers that have different pay periods and pay structures. That first of the month falls oftentimes in the midst of a pay period, and the question is, how do you allocate your PERS membership on either side of that? This restores us to the way we used to do it in Tier 1, Tier 2, and would be easier for members to administer and for employers to know when actually membership and PERS starts and when contributions are owed on salary for a member. So again, that one has a $284,000 plus fiscal impact.
Perfect. Senator Whitsitt.
That's one of your Senate Bill 370. It has a fiscal impact of $225,000 to develop the computer software, whatever. It's also going to have a significant fiscal on the PERS fund, I would think. I wonder why that hasn't been in Ways and Means.
Oh, it will be.
It has already passed this.
Passed the Senate.
It passed the Senate. It's in the House Business Committee.
That's a good question. Why hasn't it been?
That's a good question.
That's a really good question. I don't know the answer to that question. Mr. Borden?
Yeah, please. Co-chairs. You know, this is a typical, not a typical, but these measures are being tracked by LFO, and not every measure needs to come to Ways and Means. You know, part of it is, you know, there's the end of session omnibus bill where costs like these can be captured, but also the costs need to be looked at to the entire PERS IT requests and other packages that are approved, because there could be some duplication or some economies of scale that can be captured. So, and also lastly, if I may, co-chair mm-hmm. members of the committee, the House does have the opportunity to send that bill to Ways and Means once it's done with it. So,
opportunity or requirement?
Opportunity.
Co-chair and Senator Johnson, the Speaker's office would make that determination on the bill.
Yeah, Madam Co-chair.
So, just out of curiosity, do we have a guesstimate as to how many people this would affect?
Co-chair Smith, Senator Hayward, I can't predict that, because I don't know how many people get divorced in the course of their career. I know how many people are married when they retire, and I don't know how many people divorced and come to me with administration of a decree. But with this creating a new benefit, at least as I understand the bill, it would give a person who, in the course of their OPSERP retirement, or sorry, in the course of their OPSERP career, incentive to get a divorce. And so they create the entitlement to this benefit. I can't tell you how many people are going to alter their behavior to take advantage of this.
This is making my head hurt.
Yeah. This is weird.
All right.
I'm sorry. I mean, alter your.
Senator Whitsitt, why don't I talk to you after the hearing?
All right. So we're going to wrap it up for the day. Is that all right?
Please.
All right.
By divorce.
Colleagues, we appreciate you participating in this conversation. John, is there anything we need to think about as we wrap up? I'll come right to you in here.
Co-chair and member of the subcommittee, tomorrow is House Bill 2960 scheduled for public hearing and work session. And the materials for that measure will be posted to OLIS probably mid-morning tomorrow at the latest.
Perfect. Thank you. All righty, Madam Co-Chair.
Well, that was what I was going to say.
All right. Any other comments from the committee? Questions? We're good? All right. We are going to adjourn for the day. Thank you very much for being here.
Every year, I'm an officer. Okay. If I die before retirement, I'm an officer. Okay. If I die before retirement, every year.